We're going back into publishing today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Our guest today is Reggie McLeod of Big River Magazine. You could even say he is Big River Magazine, even as Garrison Keillor is the Writer's Almanac on Scribble. That's a mighty nice publication you have there.
Well, thank you.
I mean, it's just, it's beautifully done. Pictures are glorious. The text is interesting. And you, in the recent issue, I found a lot of things I want to know more about.
Oh, great.
It is the only magazine I have to say I read cover to cover. But I read it from back to front. Because what really intrigues me are those ads. I'm not to make fun of the content. The content is good too, but those ads make, I got to go to that bed and breakfast. I got to go to that restaurant. I can hardly wait to go here and there. You know, because even the photographs and the ads are spectacular.
Yeah, well, most of the advertisers are small, independent, often family-owned businesses, and they truly are unique. Because they're doing their own thing, and it's so many businesses and so many places that we do business with are franchises or chains or just an office of some huge multinational company. So they tend to be like that, which makes them more interesting.
Let me start with an aside. The only other publication where you read back to front is the London Review of Books for the personal ads. They are a source of interest or scandal, depending on your worldview.
Well, let's start at the beginning, Reggie. What in the world possessed you to even begin a magazine in an age when magazines seem to be going under one after another?
Well, I started it before they started going under, so that's part of the thing. I started it in '93, and the other reason is. Poor business judgment, I think. We're the only magazine, independent magazine in the world about a river. And when I discovered that, I was proud of the fact for quite a while. But then I slowly came to realize that the reason there weren't any others is that it's a bad business model. So I'm... I had been a freelance writer for about 13 years before that, and I had done a lot of stories about the river, and I always loved doing stories about the river, but I didn't think it was getting the coverage I deserved, and that's kind of why, had I been a business person, I probably wouldn't have done it, but coming at it with the business sense of a freelance writer, I thought it was a good idea.
But how did you go about beginning it? I remember when I first came across it and subscribed immediately, it seemed to me it was just a few-page newsletter.
Yeah.
Right? Wasn't it?
It was a 6-page newsletter, then an 8-page newsletter, and then around 2000, we started taking ads and developing it into a color magazine. So from about 2000, then by 2002, it was a color magazine.
Mm-hmm. You know, that is a big step. WVIK used to put out a magazine called Communique, and we found out there's a profound difference in sending out something without ads and then mailing something with ads. It costs more, it's a little more complicated, and so on. So that is a big step when you start taking ads.
Yeah.
The slope gets a little steeper, doesn't it?
Well, and sometimes I wonder if we're really making money having ads or whether it's costing us. Yeah, it's
well,
it's
part
tough.
Of the reason I subscribe is the ads.
Yeah, well, we do it for Roald, so.
Well, I'm not the only one. I mean, people are fascinated by the advertising you have in there.
We get a lot of good feedback on the ads. And coming as a writer, There was always this issue of church, what they call church and state in publishing, which means the ads in a good publication, the ads shouldn't affect the editorial content. And that a lot of publications don't observe that, but the good newspapers and the good magazines keep them separate, and that's what it's church and state. And so I always had was always holding the ads at arm's length, kind of as a journalist. And so I was kind of slow to take to the idea of having advertising, but I think it's helped us have a color magazine, and actually I think it has made the magazine more interesting. It adds another dimension to it, and they really don't affect the stories that we write because we have advertisers. I don't know if I should even say this, but, you know, we've had advertisers who have been there for many years that we've never written about in a story. And when they ask me that, I say, in an ad, you can say whatever you want about your business, and that's your space. And we're going to do stories for our readers. We're working for the readers. And we'll give you room to advertise and talk to our readers. So we still maintain that church and state state.
No wonder you're not making a fortune.
Yeah, I know.
Why did you choose, and was this true from the very beginning, the Twin Cities to the Quad Cities?
Well, at the beginning, it was the Twin Cities to Dubuque. And then, and people want us to do the whole river, and I don't think we'd do a very, we'd be spread too thin if we tried to do the whole river, of course. And then we took Twin Cities to the Quad Cities because it really kind of defines an area of the river that is, I hate the word special, but okay, it's a stretch of the river that has a geological sameness because it's the Driftless area. So the Quad Cities and the Twin Cities kind of bracket the Driftless area, and that's why that area in between has the steep bluffs and a lot of islands in the river, and you know, it's a certain area, and now that's becoming a whole cultural identity in the last few years. I have a bumper sticker on my car that says Driftless, and you'll see a lot of those now.
What exactly does that mean?
It means it's the area that was not scraped flat by during the last glacial age.
Mm-hmm.
So the rest of the country around that is much flatter, and even south of the Driftless area. So the glaciers actually went south of the Driftless area in both directions and flattened it out. So it's like an island of steep rocky bluffs with caves and sinkholes, and it's a geological
terrain. It's a more interesting area. So.
Well, it is, and the cultural effect it's had is because of the steep topography. People can't have big farms. I mean, there have been people that have tried to have 5,000-acre farms and so on in the Driftless area, and they usually go bankrupt because it's so inefficient to work really big fields. I mean, you can't. You have to have a bunch of small fields in the Driftless area. So that, in turn, has kind of created a culture now. You're seeing more organic agriculture in the area. You're seeing, you know, there's like a second generation of kind of back-to-the-landers, you know, the movement that started in the late 60s, early 70s. Now there are a lot of people in their 20s that are doing the same thing. And there's actually – and we have to do a story about this soon. I should keep this a secret, but I won't. There are people actually raising organic shrimp in the Driftless area.
Now that is odd.
That's bizarre, yeah.
Yeah, it is. So many things are moving from the ocean inland. The ocean, I think, shortly will have more plastic in it than fish. And that is a terrible thought.
Yeah, it is. And that's kind of the story of rivers, is you rivers don't carry away waste. They kind of concentrated in the ocean, and that's why you have the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico and all this plastic. I mean, some of it's from coastal areas, but anything that goes in a river eventually finds its way to the ocean.
Yeah, and the effect is certainly felt, I'll say. But you do positive stories for the most part, don't you?
Well, Yes.
Except for fracking, right?
Except for fracking.
Well, we've been kind of tough on some of the Army Corps of Engineers projects. Right. And we certainly write environmental stories and so on, but we don't we try to do good journalism. So we have written a lot about agricultural pollution in the rivers. We've written a lot about the negative effect of the lock and dam systems on the Mississippi River and issues like that. But we're also writing about wildlife, recreation, activities, history, because those things are all linked together. They all affect each other. History, I mean, if we have environmental problems, those are all came to us through history, you know. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to link it all together, too.
How much of the magazine do you write?
Sometimes all I write is the editorial in the front. I'm kind of a heavy-handed editor. But when I edit a story, I always try to keep the voice in it of the person and the perspective. In fact, sometimes I've taken 40% of the words out of a story. And then we always let our writers review the story afterwards. And I've had people say, oh, you hardly changed this at all. And I go, no, I didn't. I didn't need to change it much. So I put a lot of effort into the editing a lot of times. And I tend to do the stories that are more complicated that I'm kind of worried about handing off to someone mm-hmm. sometimes.
Where do you get your contributors?
Wherever we can find them. We have a pretty good variety of people writing. A lot of times they contact us. When I started out, I had some friends who were professionals. One was a writer for the Minneapolis Star Tribune, and another was a freelancer who was also on the board of the National Writers Union, and people with a lot of experience. And I talked them into doing some stories for free for the first year or two. And that helped get the ball rolling. But now we have all sorts of people. We have a couple of tow pilots who write for us regularly. We have a guy who's been doing a lot of interesting, what he calls hook and bullet stuff with fishing and hunting, who is a fireman and a first responder for many years in southeastern Wisconsin. Now he's a fishing guide out of New Albany, Iowa.
Huh.
And then Pam Iden, who's one of the editors, she used to write for the weeklies up in the Twin Cities, and she also did a lot of writing about Eskimo art and culture. So it's a pretty broad variety of people. It's people who like the magazine. I like our writers to be familiar with the magazine before they talk to us about it.
How much of the photography is done by you?
Very little. I do these loop stories sometimes that look at a section of the river between two bridges, you know, about a 30-mile
section. But the photography is way above and beyond what you would find in an average magazine.
Yeah, and that's why it's not mine, because when I was a freelancer, the highest—
No, but it's so consistently good.
Oh, it's from a lot of sources, though. Pam Iden is our news and photography editor. And she has a long list of photographers. So for every magazine, she might say, we're going to do a story on frogs. Send me your frog photos. We're going to do a story on towboats. Send me this type of photo. So she has a really good stable of photographers that she contacts. The guy that's had the most photos on the cover is a guy named Robert Hurt, who lives in Dakota, Minnesota. And he was an architect, and he got involved in a nonprofit that had a grant to do a thing on the environment of the river valley. And to get some good photos, he rented an airplane and took some aerial photos and just became totally passionate about taking photographs of the river from airplanes. So the January-February cover with the snow on the bluffs, that's one of his photos.
Doesn't he have a firm now that does that? I mean,
Hurt Photography.
Yeah. Because, and those ads are really spectacular.
Yeah.
His ads.
Well, you'll see his work on publications by the Army Corps of Engineers, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the DNRs in the states on the upper Mississippi River and that too. So he, he's had a total career change, kind of late in his career.
Let's go from church to state for a minute. What does this cost, the magazine, and how do you get it?
Well, it only, I should say, only, that's my marketing side, only is $31 a year for a subscription, and there are 6 issues a year. And you can sign up by calling 1-800-303-8201 or going online to bigrivermagazine.com. Mm-hmm. And it's in bookstores, and you can find it a lot. In fact, we just signed up 2 new distributors for the next issue, which will be out next week. And so we're in a lot of bookstores and actually in some food cooperatives and, you know, other stores as well.
Are you pleased with the circulation now?
No one's ever pleased with their circulation.
Well, I mean, you're still alive.
I don't eat very much.
I wondered how you kept so slim. You
know? It's not my choice.
That reminds me of one other thing I want to make sure to – because I don't think I've ever asked you directly, what's with you and carp?
Oh, boy, we're going to have to do a whole nother show on this.
He's had carp contests for the best restaurant that serves carp dishes.
You told me about this role several times.
Before I was at the studio, I was having lunch with one of our winners in the carp poetry contest. Well, when I was a kid, just briefly, when I was a kid, I fished a lot. And whenever we'd catch a carp, my father would either have me throw it back or give it to someone, or he'd take it home and bury it under a rose bush. And he told me you should never eat it because they tasted awful, and that only other ethnic groups didn't have enough sense not to eat carp was basically his kind of point of view of it. And that always kind of bothered me because I'd never tasted it. And when I was about 16 or 17, I was in a high school north of Detroit, and about half of my friends their parents were either from Poland or Ukraine, had come over after World War II. And I was at a Polish friend's house, and in the basement they had a big carp in a wash tub. And I was intrigued by that, and he said, that's Christmas dinner. So for Polish people and in some parts of Germany, for the most important meal of the year, which is Christmas dinner, the main dish is baked carp. And I was astounded by this. I said, you haven't talked to my father, you know. And they said, no, carp, that's wonderful. That's a delicacy. And so we kind of dared each other to eat carp at Christmas. I had to visit their house, and I kind of held my nose and ate some, and I thought, well, it just tastes like fish, you know. It's just like any other fish. So in Asia, people love carp. It's the most prized fish. It's the most heavily consumed freshwater fish in the world. So almost everywhere but here, people eat carp, and we have a wealth of carp on the Mississippi River. It's an environmental problem, and it always intrigued me that people didn't want to even try it.
Well, yes, as Hamlet says, there's nothing good or bad, but thinking makes it so. And remember that, what was it? Lobster used to be considered junk food and was only given to prisoners in Maine every day till they complained about it.
Lobster and shrimp are bugs.
Yes.
I mean, biologically, I mean, they actually are bugs.
Uh-huh. But now they're delicacies.
Yeah, and I love them myself. But when I eat them, I know that I'm eating a bug. And most people don't think about that, but I hope they do now.
and fish for carp and serve it because it really works. And write poetry about it and rhapsodize.
Yes.
Well, Reggie, I must say, you've given us a whole new view of carp. And your magazine is beautiful. And we certainly encourage everybody to part with $31 to try it. I subscribe to a new magazine at least once every year. I may only keep it for a year, but I've tried everything in the world. But the next one up is Big River. I'm tired of listening to Roll complain that I don't have a copy. So I will add me to your list.
Great.
Reggie McLeod, who is the magazine, and now the man who really is the writer's almanac, we'll turn to Garrison Keillor.